It's 8:14 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. The Steinerville Basin Planning Commission met for just 20 minutes last night, mostly to discuss the future of food trucks in the Steinerville Basin. On the phone with a quick recap, I have Planning Commissioner Thomas Cook. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, the staff report indicated that there are some good reasons for the food trucks related to small business and gathering places. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I'd love to. We looked at this pretty closely, and a lot of the planning commissioners and staff had done a lot of research and looked at case studies. And, you know, food trucks have been around since the late 1800s, but we've really seen an explosion since the end of the 2000s after the recession in gourmet food trucks. And, you know, a reason behind that is it's a way for chefs and entrepreneurs and people to get into the business with a low overhead. And another thing that's sort of enabled the, you know, the phenomenon is social media. It's a way for food trucks to build a following and stay connected with their fans. And so we just thought it provided a little bit of vibrancy and a cool opportunity. We heard a lot of input from community members that were fans of food trucks.
Yeah, and the reason you're looking at this is because some state legislation is basically, I think there had been some limitations on food trucks, but the legislation has kind of opened that up.
Yeah, there was, I don't have the, in the previous staff report that indicated, you know, one of the reasons we started looking at this now was, but it had to do with the fact that the state had changed their regulations. So food trucks could get permitted in other areas, and that was happening, and they wanted to come here, but we just did not have any regulations on the books that allowed them to operate.
Talk a little bit about the food truck court and based at basically what the Planning Commission is being asked to consider with that idea.
Yeah, I think that very much looks down the road, no pun intended, in terms of if food trucks work out and we build a vibrant, food truck scene, so to speak. There are precedents in other small urban and suburban areas where I think of a good example would, you know, we're obviously a lot smaller than Austin, Texas, but Austin, Portland, Oregon, there are places that sort of have these places where people go where there might be multiple food trucks. And I think that part of it very much looks down the road and says, you know, what if we want to have a private landowner that has some space and they want to, you know, provide some provisions for multiple food trucks to kind of have a scene? How would we approach that?
All right. Now, are the trucks governed by a code officer from the planning department or by the health department?
Well, the food trucks would definitely have to pass health department inspections, and it's pretty regulated. But as far as being allowed to operate under this new code amendment, I believe that food trucks would go through an administrative process with the county to operate in our area.
And are they basically allowed anywhere?
No, absolutely not. You know, food trucks are technically allowed in the basin if they're catering to a private party or something like that. You know, somebody has a birthday party in a cul-de-sac and they bring in a food truck for guests of the party. To my knowledge, there's no reason. We see it all the time. This code amendment would allow them in certain areas, resort center, town center, and in the commercial zones, community commercial and neighborhood commercial. And they have to be on private property, so they just can't show up and, you know, pop up their awning and start selling food on a street corner. They're pretty regulated in terms of where they can be.
Yeah, but what about like a place like a construction site where, there's a number of people gathered, but not necessarily a commercial area?
You know, that's a good question. I don't have a all the answers on that. I'm not sure. I would have to check with staff at the county how we might approach that.
Yeah, because I'm guessing, an advantage of that would be, right, we don't have all of the trucks and workers jumping into their vehicles just at lunchtime adding more traffic, yeah?
Well, I mentioned sort of, this impetus of gourmet food trucks and why they're popular. And, my familiarity before that with food trucks is, food trucks go to the construction site, a large construction site, so people don't have to leave. They can get food. And I think that, that's one side of it for sure. I think this ordinance is focused a little more on, sort of what we see is the gourmet food trucks building a following from retail customers in the community. That's actually a good point that, maybe we have to look a little more into and see, whether that, for example, the case you just brought up, if the construction site we're talking about is in a rural residential zone where they're not permitted, we'd have to look at that.
Yeah. And then finally, what's the plan to mitigate impacts on neighbors, especially if those neighbors are a brick-and-mortar restaurant?
Yeah, for sure. I think, one of the things that we've heard or we've studied in other case studies is in some cases in places where food trucks, they've looked at local governments have looked at regulating food trucks. There are cases where maybe local restaurants or restaurant associations would oppose the existence of food trucks. But we also saw a lot of case studies that showed, food trucks can be incubators for the restaurant industry. And actually, there's a great example in Wasatch County. People in our community might be familiar with Lola's food truck, and Lola's just opened a brick and mortar restaurant in Midway. And so we see a lot of this in the case studies we've looked at of, people sort of testing their ideas and building their following and then laddering up to actually opening a restaurant. So that's a good question. There are definitely other jurisdictions have ordinances that a food truck can't be within 300 feet of a brick and mortar restaurant. And we really didn't look at that. We're looking at, sort of allowing them in certain areas, certain mixed-use areas, where they might be as compatible with other restaurants as another restaurant.
Yeah. So this will come back to the Planning Commission for a final recommendation?
Actually, the way the process worked is that we made a positive recommendation to the County Council, and the County Council will have a look at the language as we recommended approval for it, and they'll have a chance to do what they do and massage it. But we made a positive recommendation to the council to consider the code amendment.
Okay. Anything else from last night or maybe a heads up of what's coming before the Basin Planning Commission?
Honestly, it was a pretty quiet night last night. I'd say, we did have a public hearing on this and didn't have any input last night per se, but we have had some positive public input on the food truck issue. This one's been on and off the agenda for a while. We've been working on it for a while. But in general, last night was pretty quiet.
Okay. I appreciate your time this morning, Thomas.
Thanks for having me.
That's Snyderville Basin Planning Commissioner Thomas Cook. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. 8:27, good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Park City Council meets Thursday in a study session starting at 3:45 in the studio to preview some of the agenda items. I have Park City Manager Diane Foster along with Planner Hannah Tyler. Good morning.
Good morning.
Diane, social equity back before the council during a study session starting at 3:45. Staff has prepared a skeleton of a request for proposal as the council had asked at the last meeting. So what's the council looking to do with this RFP?
With this RFP, this has evolved over time. And as you'll remember, Council Member Nan Worrell last summer brought up the topic and council discussed it a lot over the fall and into the early winter. And at the retreat, made it a critical priority simply because it's an important issue in our community, and the City Council always wants to reflect the things that the community cares about. So the critical priorities are transportation, housing, energy, and social equity. When we started, one of the things that we realized is that this is a big topic, right? It's a lot of times people will say, well, social equity, maybe it's creating better opportunities for people with disabilities, or maybe it's helping out seniors, or maybe it's providing opportunities for the Latino community. And the reality is it's all of these, plus LGBTQ issues, and just operating differently. So anyway, one of the things that we started with an RFP for a coordinator for social equity, and then it was kind of felt like that didn't quite fit, and that's what we heard from City Council. And so through this process and through the help of Professor Kilo Zamora, who teaches down at the U and who's has spent 30 years in this space, we determined that what council told us they want is really a convener, someone who can provide, and what's the, you know, the two questions are what's needed and what is an appropriate role for the city. And so, you know, we're not necessarily a social service provider. The county provides a lot of awesome services in that arena, and that's traditionally some of the differences in city-county roles. What they did come to is that we can have a role there. What City Council has is they have a platform and they have the ability to talk to the community and reflect things from the community. And so being a convener, bringing people together to ask questions, what gaps are there, what other services are needed, and how can we help, and who else can help. It also very much respects the other community players. We have so many nonprofits in our community providing services across a lot of different areas, and they've been doing this a lot longer than we have. So we want to respect their role and also be appropriate.
So when you think about a coordinator being a single person and a convener more of an organization that can do this, is that the difference?
It's actually, I think, the biggest difference is the function. So what this person's going to do. And it's really around saying, hey, we want to have everybody at the table, and we're willing to facilitate those conversations, and we're willing to do heavy lifting around things like if you know, we have heard some feedback that it would be good to put together a strategic plan that, and actually first and foremost, a gap analysis about what services aren't available in the community and are needed. And so that convener would really be responsible for kind of making those things happen. And for this RFP, an individual could respond, or an organization could respond. We do expect a couple nonprofits in the community to respond, as they do some of this function anyway, and a number of them are good at it.
Such as?
I think the two that come to mind as either having been a convener in the past, so Park City Community Foundation has been very much a convener on the mental wellness issue, and then they launched that. Obviously, they handed that off. They didn't own it, but they were a convener in that. And the other one that comes to mind is the Christian Center. They're probably the organization that provides the most diverse services, although we also have partners like the People's Health Clinic, and they're super strong, as well as the Peace House. And a lot of, you know, Mountainland Association of Governments provides a Wheels on Meals program. So there are a lot of folks providing services. It's just, you know, we're not sure who would want to do it.
So one of the blanks that needs to be filled in is the price tag. Any guesses what this is looking like?
City Council has allocated for this fiscal year $100,000 to that. We actually don't know. And I think this is one of those areas that we want to put our toe in the water and figure out where can we be useful. And, you know, the city, we've been successful in recent years in pilot programs. So the idea that we could try this out and then see, hey, what works and what fits. It's also important that we always, as a city, look for grants and other types of things. And while we don't want to take money from other organizations, I would expect that this convener would also be looking for and may end up looking at, are there other funding sources to support this?
This is scheduled also for a decision on the regular agenda, so you expect a decision to happen on Thursday?
It's we do expect direction, and you know, technically City Council doesn't have to vote to issue an RFP because they would vote on the contract. So however, this is one that you know, City Council has absolutely driven this, and as staff, we want to make sure that we're issuing the right thing. It's also important to note that at 3:45, the start of the social equity discussion is a little bit different topic. Holy Cross Ministries, in conjunction with some volunteers in their organization, have put together a video, and it's titled, I don't know if I have the exact title right, but it's A Day in the Life of an Immigrant Family in Park City. It's a 12-minute video, and I had an opportunity to see it, and it was wonderfully stunning and heartwarming, and you instantly connected with this family. And I think it's a great tool to talk about social equity in our community, and so that's what we're going to do. City Council, you know, I was emailing last evening with the person who kind of whose idea it was and the genesis of it, although it was definitely a team effort. And she called it the premiere of the video. So
will Professor Zamora be back to speak with the council? He had a presentation planned for the last meeting, but that never happened.
He did. And in fact, he had one scheduled for this meeting, and his wife, who was a classmate of mine from the University of Utah, my graduate school, she surprised him with a trip to Oregon, and I don't think she knew he had this scheduled because his classes don't start for a couple weeks. So he took that opportunity, and it's not a rush. We can get him on another agenda pretty soon.
Okay. Quickly, an update on the ICE arena. An energy audit has been done. What does that look like?
So making ICE is what the ICE people call it. When you basically resurface the ICE and refreeze it, it takes a lot of energy. And this is the team who has probably been the most forward-thinking for a number of years in the area of saving energy. And so they've and this directly relates to when you save energy, you save money. And they have actually reduced their subsidy at the ice rink. So the city council basically says, hey, you can have up to a $350,000 subsidy because it's very hard to have rinks be profitable. Even though someone is building one over at the entrance to Browns Canyon, and we hope he is profitable, and we hope he can increase the amount of ice availability in the community. But our team has actually reduced their subsidy down to roughly $82,000 this past year, and their target for next year is only a $62,000 subsidy. So it's basically nearly a break-even facility, and energy is a huge part of that.
Yeah. Are there ways, though, to lower those energy costs? I mean, does it just mean less maintenance on the ice? Or
you know, one of the things that they were able to do, training staff is incredibly important in any organization, and we take it very seriously. One of the things that that we did was we had one of our Mike Dearson, who's our operations manager. He went over to Korea for the Olympics, and he learned a lot. And one of the things that they've been able to do, and this isn't necessarily directly from the Olympics, but one of the things they've been able to do is increase the temperature of the ice, so from 22 to 24 degrees. And then for hockey, it goes from 19 to 22. So there, and it ends up creating a significant improvement in that. And so having the right set point on temperature can save tons of money. And these folks, they look for every little piece of energy savings that they can find.
Okay. And let's turn to you. The city council will discuss in work session at 5:15 the recommendations for the accessory apartment parking. The Planning Commission is scheduled to make a recommendation on that tonight?
No, this is actually for City Council. And so all we're asking for is direction as to whether or not they want us to research a possible parking exemption for accessory apartments. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, looking at this in a neighborhood scale, this doesn't necessarily benefit every property because there are some properties that can provide parking. But who this is going to benefit is those sites who cannot provide on-site parking. And it would allow them to then, you know, get a little bit of extra income, provide an accessory apartment, and then also get a deed-restricted affordable unit for our housing stock.
Yeah. Didn't the city already allow less parking, though? I mean, I'm thinking of the Woodside Park first phase. I mean, we reduced parking there. Some of those units have accessory units. So is this coming after the fact?
So I guess to clarify, we did not reduce parking for Woodside Park Phase 1. We did provide the, you know, land management code required parking for that. What we're looking at in the affordable housing MPD is a micro unit exemption. And I think, you know, looking at this from a density scale, the density of a residential zone is very different than the density of an MPD. And so some of that parking could be sort of trickled in through the MPD process. And also we have controls over CCNRs in those scenarios. And so we're just asking, is this something that they want to talk about? They talked about it as a part of the general plan. The neighborhoods did come out at that time, and so they wanted to bring it back up again.
Okay. So is there a staff recommendation on this?
No, we're just asking for direction as to whether or not they want us to research it. We've brought forward some of the concerns we do have, and we're hoping that we can discuss that, you know, briefly and then sort of move forward if it's something they want us to do.
Yeah, those concerns being what? Some areas are already...
Where are the cars going to go?
Mm-hmm.
And if you do deed restrict it and say they can't own a car, who's going to police that? Do you want city staff to have more code enforcement? Because there are some impacts to this. You know, unintended and intended consequences of it. And so these are sort of the hard conversations we need to have. But if it's worth getting more housing in our affordable housing stock, then we need to have a community discussion about this with our residential neighborhoods.
Okay. And so is this for new construction or is this for somebody who may remodel and try and add an accessory unit?
It can be for both. An existing property could remodel an existing house or add an addition depending on what their footprint is and that sort of thing. But it's sort of for everyone. And what we'd like to look at is if a property can provide parking on site, we'd like to encourage that and not just give them a parking exemption because, again, people own cars. In the future, we'd love it if everyone didn't. But right now, we know people are going to come. They're going to have bikes. They're still going to have a car. And we need to put that car somewhere. So that's sort of the discussion we need to have.
All right.
And one of the things I do love about this particular piece is it's a good example of the land management code is a living document. And a lot of times people think, well, those are the rules. They can't be changed. This is an example. And the impetus for this particular one was there's someone in Prospector who wanted to do an accessory unit. They didn't have the setbacks and the space to meet the land management code requirements for accessory unit parking. And I actually said to somebody yesterday, this is a community where if you have a concern, you can come to city council and they hear you and they listen to you. And now the challenge that city council always has is balancing, right? So how do you balance our absolute desire and need for accessory units with the need to provide parking, at least now until we get rid of cars. So it's a wonderful balancing act. It's also a great opportunity for us to, as Hannah mentioned, highlight that accessory units are allowed in most of the single family are allowed in the single family zone. Some HOAs do prohibit them, but it's a great way that you can really contribute to the community in building an accessory unit in your home, or provide a, you know, give a, put up for rent a bedroom or something like that. It is an opportunity, and the county does provide, if you have a long-term rental for a house, you could actually get a exemption on your tax. You could have the 55% discount.
Yeah. So, Hannah, is this the meeting for people to be at if they do have concerns about it, or is this coming back to council for a final decision?
You know, it's a work session, so we're just asking for a direction, but it will go through the planning process on that. If they tell us to move forward with this, we will take it to Planning Commission, and there'll be a public hearing there, and then it'll go to council. So there'll be plenty of opportunity for input, and we'd welcome comments, because I think getting the community to be involved in this one's going to be really important, because it's where you live.
All right, let's talk a little bit about 424 Woodside Avenue. The applicant here wants to rotate the building 180 degrees so that it faces Woodside rather than Main Street, and then want to move it. So why is this a problem?
So to clarify, the applicant or the appellant is appealing the Historic Preservation Board's denial of that rotation and relocation. And this is a significant site on the historic sites inventory that faces Main Street, which is one of the many development patterns that we had, and it's pretty unique. And so what they're proposing is to turn it so that it faces the current street, which is Woodside Avenue. And so it's an issue because this is really about the historic district and protecting what our development pattern was. And that in order for it to rotate, it would have to meet the criteria. And some of the criteria they simply don't meet. And some of that is that there are hazardous conditions on the site. And we involved the chief building official, the city engineer, and the planning director. We reviewed the what was submitted by the applicant at the time. Now, they are now an appellant. But simply we didn't find hazardous conditions that were unique to this site that weren't common throughout town. And that can include drainage and, you know, snow runoff and things like that. And so at this point, it's an appeal of the HPB's determination, and staff is recommending that they uphold the HPB's determination, but we're obviously asking for council to discuss it at length.
All right. The appellant, my understanding is that the Historic Preservation Board erred by relying on a historical analysis that incorrectly applied the wrong criteria associated with landmark sites instead of the criteria for a significant site. Does that?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the, I think they had 5 points of their appeal, and that's just one of them. Staff does not find that we applied the landmark criteria. We did apply the significant criteria, specifically that a historic site has to maintain some level of integrity in order to remain historic. And what we found is that its orientation towards Main Street is one of the last pieces of integrity, because it has been, you know, it has an addition. It's been kind of altered over the years. And so that orientation is so important to that historic site and keeping that designation, that that's what we're concerned about. And our historic preservation consultant also concurred with that, and that was what the HPB relied on.
Okay. Finally, Diane wanted to mention just real quickly, the council will get a mid-season Summit Bike Share update. We've seen some great use of the 32,000 miles have been traveled, 9,500 trips taken. Anything, though, that the council wants to see mitigated for the future?
I think the impetus for this initially, I think actually Julia Collins, transportation planner, she had this in the works when council expressed, as you discussed with Caroline Rodriguez yesterday, some of the concerns about, you know, kids riding the bikes and things like that. That was the initial impetus, and I think Caroline did a nice job of addressing that yesterday, that we are concerned and we do address those, although I think what the important part of this report is it that does not overshadow the incredible success of this program. In fact, yesterday I was talking to Pat Putt, and I'll steal his story. He stopped a couple people who were on e-bikes out in Silver Summit, and they were newlyweds, and they had taken a shuttle up from the airport, and they had ridden the e-bikes the entire time that they were here, and they had gone from downtown Park City out to Kimball Junction on their e-bikes, and they were loving it. And I think that is more the story that we hear than, you know, kids with their friend in the basket or something like that. And that is so we are super excited about this and look forward to continuing to expand the program.
Okay. Diane, Hannah, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
8:46 now. Good morning. Well, with the dog days of summer here and more heat in the forecast, we thought it would be a good time to talk about how to keep yourself and your pets safe in the heat. In the studio, I have Summit County Health Department educator Alyssa Mitchell. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So any idea, I mean, in terms of what our EMTs might see in terms of incidents for heat exhaustion or heat issues?
We don't collect that data at this point. What I can say is nationwide, we've had 20 deaths from children who have been left in hot cars. And it's unfortunate. And many of the times it's people who get going so fast, they get in their mindset, they run into the store, and sometimes their kids have fallen asleep in the back. Or sometimes a parent or even a pet owner is just out of their routine and they don't remember that the child or pet's in their car. And so it ends up just being a tragic accident. But what we're really wanting people to look for is if you see an animal or a child in a locked car, especially during the summer, to contact, if you're at a store, like contact the store, call 911, report it, because it is not safe for them to be in there.
Right. I mean, and there's some talk about whether or not you should break the window. I mean, call the cops first.
Yes, definitely call the cops first. You just have to go based off of your gut. If you call, like if you're at a store and security comes out, security can definitely break the window, or law enforcement can definitely break the window, but definitely call first and make sure that you're able to do that.
So those 20 deaths, that's just this summer?
That's just this summer so far. Last year, Safe Kids Worldwide reported, I believe, 29 deaths total for last year. And every year it keeps going up. And again, it's just for various different reasons. Most of the time it's an accident. It's unintentional. It'll be like a parent who doesn't normally take the child to daycare, who's supposed to take the child to daycare, and then they fall asleep and they forget about it. the child, or there's been a few cases of people doing it on purpose, but usually there's legal repercussions if they're able to prove that.
Wow. So talk just a little bit, if you can, about just in terms of what happens inside a car on a, you know, 80, 85 degree day.
Sure. After about 10 minutes, the heat inside your car doubles. So if it's 80 degrees outside within 10 minutes, that could be 100 or 120 degrees. And people, unfortunately, even with pets, they think, oh, if I just roll down the window and crack it a little bit, the dog or the children will be okay while I run in and quickly do this errand. It's not the case. It is still hot. I believe the temperature is 106 degrees to start killing brain cells and causing internal damage for children and pets. And that can happen so quickly, even if it's just 80 degrees outside, even if you're parked in the shade. So really what we like to tell people is if you have an errand to run, if you have a place you need to go that doesn't allow pets, find a place, either find a place where you can take your kids and pets, get a sitter of some kind, or just know that if you go, you need to just take them in with you. And I'm a mom. I have a 4-year-old and an almost 2-year-old, and it's not easy trying to take them into the places. You know, they run around, they touch things. And so if it's a place that is not kid friendly or pet friendly, because there's plenty of restaurants or buildings you can't take pets into unless they're a service dog, it's better to find somebody to watch your pet or watch your kids, then make the trip so that you're not putting anybody at risk.
Okay. Also, I guess we should just talk a little bit about, you know, there's people certainly who have no choice and have to work outside in hot weather. Any recommendations there?
Absolutely. So first of all, make sure if you're outside for a very long time, you have some water with you. Stay hydrated. It's a really easy time of the year to forget to take a drink. We also recommend wearing sunscreen. SPF 30 is the bare minimum of what you should do. And you should reapply every 2 hours, and actually even more frequently if you're swimming. Also, hats are a great way to keep your head cool and keep the sun out of your face. And especially if you're out on the trails, sometimes wearing long sleeves or long pants can help keep the UV rays off of you for longer periods of time. And you can actually get some nice breathable UV protectant clothing as well at some stores. So that's something to consider. And just, again, remember that water. It is hot out there right now, and we want people to stay hydrated.
Yeah. And then in terms of there's heat exhaustion and then heat stroke, which I think is life-threatening, huh?
Heat stroke can be life-threatening. So heat exhaustion, you're dehydrated. You're still able to function as a person, but you'll feel sick. Heat stroke, generally what we see is people become unresponsive. They can't think clearly. And in either case, you should go see medical attention immediately. Some of the warning signs of that are not able to breathe very clearly. You're very pale and clammy. You're sweating really profusely. And sometimes even with heat stroke, you actually stop sweating just because your body's trying to function in other places. So ways to prevent that are to make sure to take breaks, stay in the take shade breaks, take lots of water with you, and honestly avoid the peak heat times of the day. So try, especially if you're out on the trails, early morning or late in the evening are the better times to go versus in the middle of the day when it's super hot.
Okay. More information on the website?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Alyssa, anything else?
Be safe out there. Enjoy your summer and always pack lots of water and remember that sunscreen.
Okay, Alyssa Mitchell, a health educator with the Summit County Health Department. KPC-nominated singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist Grace Potter returning to Park City as part of the Big Stars Bright Nights concert series on July 13th. She'll be performing at City Park. She joins me now on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So tell us about who you're bringing with you. You'll be singing, of course, and playing music, but you've got a band coming with you?
Yes. I do. I've got my band coming with me. We're actually reuniting very shortly here in California to rehearse and get going. And we'll be living all in one house and rehearsing in a funky old venue here in California. And so it'll be a 5-piece rock and roll extravaganza.
Great. Now, Park City is just part of a summer tour that you've got going on. Taking you where?
Well, we'll be the weekend before Park City. We'll be in way up in Northern California in Quincy at High Sierra Music Festival, and then the day after Park City, we're actually taking another trek up into Telluride, Colorado, and we'll be in Montana in August, and then ultimately we're going to end up in Vermont, my home state, for my music festival, Grand Point North.
Well, you have a young baby boy with you this time, Sagan. That must put a whole new spin to the touring life, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. It's all kind of in test drive mode right now, having him out on the road. But so far, he's been amazing. We recently traveled to Washington, D.C. to perform at the Kennedy Center with the National Symphony Orchestra. And he was awesome. Very, very well-behaved baby. Enjoyed the airplane very much. And so he seems to be taking to the road very well so far.
Well, great. So a lot of help from mothers to make it happen, though?
My husband is an incredible help. He and Sagan have a wonderful bond, and they certainly know what to do. They hang out and dance side stage when they watch mom doing her thing. And so as the band arrives and we start rehearsals, I imagine he's going to be in a lot of people's arms, especially our drummer, Matt Musty, can't keep his hands off Sagan. They have a very tight bond, so those two like to hang out a lot.
Yes.
And who knows? Yeah, I think he'll be hanging out with everybody and just getting in the mix. He's a very social baby.
Great. So you'll be playing some of your own music as well as some covers?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it'll mostly be my music. You know, we always like to throw a cover in there, or at least one or two. But for the most part, as I've created this career, it's kind of incredible. I've been going back through the songs and realizing, man, I have a huge artillery of songs to choose from. So we'll be rehearsing and kind of narrowing down what is going to be the most fun, you know, summertime rock and roll show. And making sure that we hit on a few crowd favorites. And we might throw in a cover song or two, but for the most part, it'll be music from my last 5 albums.
Yeah, yeah.
Touching on a little bit of everything.
So, I mean, given that you literally have had your hands full, I mean, have you had time to write new music?
Yeah, I just started writing some new music. You know, I guess it was about 6 months ago that I got more serious about thinking about an album and figuring out when we would put it out. So we have been writing. I've got some amazing help here at home. We have a home studio, and my husband is also an awesome songwriter and producer. So we've been digging in, and there's a lot of amazing music coming out of this little garage studio that we have. And actually looking at a snake cable right now, we're about to record drums and piano in our living room. So I'm staring at the mess right now, and it's exciting.
Great. Well, again, Grace Potter and her band will be in Park City, City Park, on July 13th. Showtime is 6 p.m. Tickets start at $49. For tickets or more information, it's parkcityinstitute.org, or you can contact the box office at 435-655-3114. Look forward to seeing you, Grace.
Thank you so much. We'll see you soon.